Okay, so I'm hoping it will be an enlightening experience for both of us. As you'll see, I have more of an astrophysical bent to my title, but the meaning of this will shortly become clear. The overall problem that I'm interested people in my group is the question of biological motion. How do you actually take chemical energy that's generated by metabolic processes in living organisms and turn that into mechanical energy that will enable force to be generated and enable directed movement to happen? Directed movement really is one of the things that we most closely associate with biological systems, with all forms of life. And understanding the fundamental nature of how that works is, I think, a very big problem still in biology. And in general, this problem comes down to understanding different types of biological motors, that is, different types of machinery to actually transduce chemical energy into mechanical energy. And some of these will probably be very familiar to physicists in the audience. One of the biological motors most beloved of physicists is the rotary motor that drives swimming bacteria. This has been very well studied at a number of different levels. Another problem that's attracted the attention of physicists is a different kind of motor, a linear stepper motor, where you have a filament system and then a protein that binds to the filament and undergoes a conformational change coupled to a chemical reaction that enables motion along that filament. This, for example, is the way that our muscles contract. There is, in fact, a bacterial form of jet propulsion, which is a very specialized form of bacterial motility referred to as gliding, where the bacteria actually secrete a very viscous exopolysaccharide that pushes them forward through really a low Reynolds number analogy of true jet propulsion. But the fourth type, which is fairly unfamiliar to most people outside of cell biology, and it's going to be the focus of the work I'll describe today, is a motor that operates by linear assembly and disassembly of protein subunits. And the most interesting, to me, example of where this becomes important in biology is in the process of cell crawling. This is going to be a movie that was made by David Rogers at Vanderbilt University in the late 1950s with a video camera hooked up to a microscope. And what you're looking at is a blood smear from a normal, healthy person. There are little red blood cells around the outside, the circles. Oh, good, we have a stick. And this creature right here is a neutrophil. It's a white blood cell that's part of the immune system to fight infection. And in this particular blood smear, the investigators added a couple of bacteria. And so the neutrophil is going to chase the bacterium and try to engulf it. And the bacterium's right there. The digitization gets a little better as soon as it starts to close. The little dot, the little black thing. And you see the bacterium, of course, is trying to swim away. And the neutrophil, this is real time, the neutrophil chases after it. And every time the bacterium tries to duck around a red blood cell, the neutrophil changes its polarity and starts going towards where the bacterium is, follows it through thick and thin, and then finally catches up and engulfs it. So this is a beautiful illustration of why this is such a large problem. The cell is made up of proteins that are very small. They're a few nanometers in diameter. The cell, though, is 10 microns across. So there's a scaling, a structural scaling, to go from its components to its actual overall organization of 4 orders of magnitude. And yet that structural scaling has to be so dynamic and so flexible that it can completely change its orientation when the bacterium moves away so that it's able to chase after it with this kind of time scale. Yeah, well, the bacterium's got one of those rotary motors, and so it's actually in pretty good shape. So if we're trying to understand the problem of cell structure and cell movement, it turns out they're all wrapped up in the same sorts of issues, which is understanding the scaling problem, how you go from tiny proteins to large-scale organization in cells. And basically, to a first approximation, the answer turns out to be that large-scale cell organization depends on filamentous structures. And those filamentous structures are themselves made of thousands and thousands of identical copies of the same protein subunit that self-associate to form helical polymers inside of cells. And just a little bit of biological background, in human cells, there are essentially three major kinds of these protein filament systems, and they have different functions. Intermediate filaments act to give cells mechanical integrity. They're very easy to bend, but very hard to break. And so they're, for example, the thing that stops your skin from blistering every time you're touched. Microtubules are very stiff polymers that are also very dynamic, that are responsible for laying down tracks that vesicles move on inside of cells, and they also pull the chromosomes apart during cell division. The polymer system I'm going to focus on is one called actin. This is the major filamentous protein in your muscle cells, but in other cells it also forms filamentous structures that tend to determine the edge of the cell, the shape of the cell. And if you think back to that crawling cell, the way that cells crawl is they'll extend a new edge, and it is actin growth at that new edge that actually extends the cell. And so understanding cell crawling is going to come down to understanding how cells know where to grow their actin filaments and how that growth of actin filaments actually generates forces that enable the cells to crawl around. So this system obviously is going to be terribly complex. And I want to first go through a little bit of structural background. This is a whole cell. This is 50 microns across. And each one of these filaments that you see in the micrograph is a bundle of tens or hundreds of individual actin filaments. The actin filaments themselves have a very simple structure. It's just a helical polymer made up of identical subunits that are all pointing in the same direction. So they bind head to tail, and that means that the filament has an overall polarity, which ends up being very useful for the cell because this is a way to translate tiny polarity on the level of the protein to large-scale polarity as these things reach across the cell. This picture that you see over here is a ribbon diagram of the way that the protein folds up. Proteins, as I think you probably all know, are initially made as linear strings of amino acids, and they fold to form the three-dimensional structure that will enable them to have their function. And going from a linear three-dimensional polymer to a folded protein can, in a sense, be thought of as the same type of scaling problem that we're talking about here, except on a much smaller level. So these tiny folded proteins will all self-associate to form a helical filament. These are electron micrographs of actual filaments. So you see the structure of the starting subunit is really very simple. The reason the neutrophil is able to crawl around with this is that these filaments are not rigid. They're not fixed. They're very, very dynamic. And they're continually assembling and disassembling within the cell. In most cells, about half of the actin is in this filamentous form that gives structural meaning. And the other half is in monomeric form, where the small monomer is able to diffuse very quickly through the cell. The monomers will bind to the ends of filaments and thereby extend the filaments, make them one subunit longer. And then also monomers are able to come off of filaments. And through a very clever mechanism that I'm not going to have time to go into, this is timed so that new filaments contain ATP buried in the protein structure and old filaments contain ADP buried in the protein structure. And because it takes a little while for the ATP to get hydrolyzed to ADP, you can do this in a steady state mechanism where you're continually burning energy to put on new monomers at one end and take off old monomers at the other end. So the total amount of filament in the cell remains constant, but the actual subunits, the constituents in those filaments, are constantly turning over. Okay? For this kind of dynamic process, it turns out in biological systems that almost always the rate limiting step is nucleation. That is, you have to decide where to start a new filament, and then once that new filament is started, it can narrowly grow on its own. And what cells do to work out shape is they localize the spots of nucleation. And then, despite this fairly complex dynamics that's embedded in the polymer itself, inside a cell there are also hundreds or possibly thousands of different binding proteins that interact either with actin filaments or with actin subunits and change every aspect of these properties. So, to try to understand how the system really works and to get a good sort of satisfying physical answer to how forces generate and how cells crawl, what one typically does in biological research is one goes to the expert. The diversity of life on this planet is such that if you have a particular biological process you want to study, you can almost always find an organism which specializes in it, which is really, really good at it. And that's the organism of choice for understanding your biological process. And it turns out, fortuitously, that if you want to understand actin dynamics, the polymerization that will give you these wonderful structures, the best organism to go to is not an organism that does it itself, like a human, but rather to go to bacteria. And the reason for this, I think, is pretty interesting. I'm sure most of you don't think about this very often, but your entire body is teeming with bacteria. And in fact, if you add up all of the bacteria that live on your skin and in your digestive tract and all the other non-sterile areas of your body, there are 10 times more bacterial cells than there are human cells in the thing that you call your body. You're not really so much an organism as you are a thriving and complex ecosystem that has tens of thousands of different species living within. And most of the time, this is fine. I mean, you actually, in order to be healthy, you need to have all this microbial flora. And yet, even though in your gut, sorry?
Newborn babies also have this,
sir. I'm sorry?
And babies also have a large number of bacteria.
So that's actually a point of controversy as to how the flora gets established, because one would think that inside the amniotic sac in the uterus that it's actually fairly sterile. There are some people who don't believe that it's sterile in there. And certainly if you go in and you try to culture, you try to PCR up organisms, there's always stuff that you find. And it's not clear how much is contamination, how much is not. There are interesting studies done in mice where you can grow them for many generations in a sterile environment and, you know, take the pups away immediately and that kind of thing and get them to be in their digestive tract reasonably sterile. And what happens actually when you don't have the normal microbial flora is development doesn't happen properly. So the intestine doesn't form normally and the mice can't digest their food. And there's a whole field of inquiry as to how it is normally, as soon as a mammal is born, how it gets colonized. So I don't know if that was a very okay. So you're covered with bacteria. You just have to deal with that. In your gut, for example, you take out a gram of gut matter, and in there are probably 10 to the 13th bacteria. But at the same time, with all this stuff living all over you, if you take a glass of water that is contaminated with as few as 10 individuals of the organism Shigella flexneri, and you drink that glass of water, that will give you bloody diarrhea. So 10 to the 13th bacteria in your gut, no problem. Add 10 more, suddenly big problems. How does that work? The way that that works is that the things that live on us normally, our normal flora, are different from the things that cause disease. Organisms that cause disease, generally called pathogens, tend to differ from normal flora at a very small number of loci. There are only a tiny handful of genes that will determine whether a particular bacterium is going to be normal flora and live in there happily, or going to be something that's going to give you bloody diarrhea. And a lot of research in infectious diseases over the last 10 or 20 years has been focused on identifying what these genes are. What are the proteins that they encode that cause these terrible things to happen in our bodies in this specific way? And it almost always turns out that the way that pathogens cause disease is they express proteins that interfere with a particular aspect of normal host cell biology. So if you can find a pathogen whose job in life is to interfere with your normal host cell biology process that you want to study, you can ask the pathogen how it does that, you can do genetics and biochemistry and get the proteins out, and then you can use that as a handle to get a hold of the complex process. And for the work that I'm going to talk about, the organism that we use as the handle to get a hold of the complex process of cell motility and acting organization is a little beast called Listeria monocytogenes. This is a ubiquitous soil organism. Every time you eat a little bit of lettuce or anything that's grown in the soil, you're eating a few Listeria monocytogenes. And it's fine. The problem comes when you eat food that's been very heavily contaminated with this organism, usually cheese or meat products. And then it can cause a rare but very serious form of food poisoning, which results in meningitis, or swelling of the tissues around the brain, in immunocompromised people, and also causes spontaneous abortion in pregnant women. The death rate, once you have a full-blown listeriosis infection, the death rate is on the order of 25%. So it's a very rare infection, but it's a very serious one. For those of you who are from Europe and miss the wonderful cheese that you used to be able to get in Europe, this organism is the reason that U.S. law requires that all dairy products be pasteurized. So there's a lot of listeriosis research in France, because there it's actually a fairly common ailment. Here it's not common. You don't get it from dairy products because they have been pasteurized. But every so often there will be contamination in a slaughterhouse. And just a couple of weeks ago, October 12th, was the largest recall of meat in U.S. history. It was 27 million pounds of turkey and chicken that were recalled because of listeriosis contamination. And many of you may have seen this in the New York Times and other news outlets. And we can talk a little later perhaps about why it is that this is happening, why it is that these types of large-scale food outbreaks are becoming more and more common. A lot of it has to do with the change in our economic structure. It used to be, even 20 years ago, that when you would go to a butcher shop and buy meat, that meat was grown and slaughtered locally in some small slaughterhouse. Almost all the small slaughterhouses and small packing plants have now shut down. And meat in the U.S. is packaged in a very small number of enormous plants in the Midwest. And so when one of those plants gets contaminated, that meat then goes out to every state in the country. And Listeria is sneaky because it's able to grow at refrigerator temperatures. That's why it's such a problem. So it used to be the chicken would die, go to the butcher shop, within a couple of days somebody would buy it. Now the chicken gets shipped to Pennsylvania, somebody kills it, and then it gets shipped out in a refrigerator truck, and weeks later somebody buys it. And during those weeks in a refrigerator truck, Listeria was growing. So you may want to think about that when you consider whether you want to be a vegetarian. Now, the thing that Listeria does that makes it... Sorry? I'm not a vegetarian, because I think it's good to challenge your immune system. okay, so the thing that Listeria does that makes it useful for cell biologists is the way it causes disease is very interesting. You eat contaminated food, and some of the bacteria pass through into the small intestine. And normal bacteria in your normal flora will just pass on down there into the large intestine where they belong. Listeria wants to stay in the small intestine. It uses that as an entry port to get to the brain and the placenta and other parts of the body where it actually causes disease. And the way it does that is your intestine is lined with a single layer of cells that are all joined one to another, like a tile floor. And the bacterium attaches to the top of one of those cells, and it sends a signal across the cell membrane that tells the cell to reach out part of its processes and engulf the bacterium. And this process is essentially identical to what you saw the neutrophil doing in the movie. However, this intestinal cell is not supposed to do that process. The bacterium forces it to. So after the bacterium has forced the cell to take it up, it's now inside the cell within a membrane-bound compartment. And at this point, the bacterium secretes enzymes that destroy the host cell membrane, releasing it free into the host cell cytoplasm. And this is where it wants to be because that's where it replicates. So it grows, it goes through many generations, and while it's living in the cell and growing, it also accumulates actin filaments at its surface. And over time, those actin filaments become polarized to form a highly asymmetric structure associated with the bacterium, and the structure resembles the tail of a comet. Bacteria that are associated with these actin comet tails are moving very rapidly through the cell. And when they reach the edge of the cell, they keep going and push out a membrane-bound protrusion that's got the bacterium at the tip and the actin tail trailing behind. And in the monolayer of cells in the intestine, when that protrusion comes out the side, it can push its way into a neighboring cell. The neighboring cell engulfs the protrusion, and there the bacterium is inside a membrane-bound compartment. It starts the same trick again. So in this way, the bacterium can spread from cell to cell to cell to cell to cell throughout the entire body without ever leaving the cytoplasmic environment. So it's never exposed to antibody in the blood. So essentially, this whole fancy truck. Well, it's replicating this whole time. So from here to here, it's typically gone from being one bacterium to being four bacteria. From here to here, it's typically gone from 4 to 64. Uh-huh. And then that's about the time that spread starts. So what we really want to understand is how these bacteria move. And to give you a taste for that problem, this is a video micro video. It's a movie of of an epithelial cell in tissue culture. This one happens to be a kidney epithelial cell, but intestinal cell would look the same, that was infected about 5 hours previously with one bacterium. So here you see all these little black rods are the bacteria, and they're all the descendants of the single infecting ancestor. So they replicate very rapidly when they're in there. And behind the moving bacteria, you see these phase-dense streaks, which are the actin comet tails. And as they're moving around, you can see a bunch of interesting things happen. Like this guy divides, and then as soon as it divides, the two daughters move off. These guys, they come over to the side, and you can see they push out these protrusions. In this case, because the cell's on its own, they kind of wave around and get taken back in. But you can imagine if there were another cell sitting here, that would be a mechanism for cell-to-cell spread. This is a time-lapse movie, not like the neutrophil. This is speeded up about 60-fold over real time. And one of the things that's interesting about this biologically is that Listeria is not the only bug that has figured out how to do this trick. There are a number of unrelated bacterial pathogens that cause completely different diseases by completely different mechanisms that have independently, in evolutionary terms, figured out how to do the same thing. There's even a virus that knows how to do the same thing. So there's something about this process which is easy to do, which is easy to evolve, which suggests that there's a single key component that will be able to trigger it off. And as long as the bacterium can pick up that component, then all of these other things will happen naturally. Okay, so this is just to show that those phase-dense structures you saw were made of actin. This is a cell that's been fixed and stained so that actin filaments are green and the bacteria are red. And you see all the red bacteria living inside the cell are associated with a big comet tail of green actin filaments, or in some cases, a fairly symmetrical-looking cloud of green that covers the surface. But to really get an idea of the structure, which you need to understand for the mechanism, this is a thin-sectional electron micrograph where we can now actually begin to see the filamentous detail in each of those comet tails. So here's the bacterium. This particular one is just about to divide, as you can see, by its septum, or rather, it was about to divide when the cell was fixed. And here's the comet tail. So the comet tail is many microns long. The bacterium is 2 microns from stem to stern. And the comet tail can be 10 or 20 microns long. And each one of these little lines here is an individual actin filament, and each one of those actin filaments may be made up of 1,000 actin monomers. So somehow, this bacterium is causing the organization of this very large-scale structure that's much larger than itself, that's made up entirely of host components, host proteins, and the bacterium is somehow telling them how to assemble in such a way that it will produce movement and enable the bacterium to spread the infection. So to summarize just a little bit about what we know of the dynamics of this process, we've demonstrated that the filaments in the structure polymerize, that is the monomers associate onto filaments to allow them to grow, only immediately adjacent to the surface of the bacterium. Mm-hmm. Then, those filaments, when they grow at the surface of the bacterium, they actually are cross-linked to pre-existing filaments. So everything in this is cross-linked to everything else. That's right. So they're cross-linked in a dense branch structure. And then as they age, the filaments depolymerize. So if you were to look at what's moving in the system, the actin filaments actually remain stationary. The bacterium moves because new actin filaments grow at the surface and somehow push it forward. And then over time, because of that timing mechanism I told you about with ATP hydrolysis hooked up to the actin dynamics, old filaments are disassembled, they make new monomers, the monomers diffuse around, and they can come back here and pile up again at the front, enabling this to work at steady state. So mainly, what I want to convince you of today is that protein polymerization, this act of assembling and disassembling helical filaments, is a very good way to generate biological force. It can act as a molecular motor in the strict sense that a molecular motor is something that can convert chemical energy to mechanical energy in a biological system. Today I'm only going to talk about actin filaments, but another very popular system for studying this kind of force generated by protein polymerization is microtubules, which I showed you a picture of in a previous slide, which Deborah Feigenson here, her research focuses on aspects of that particular problem. So although I'm going to tell you about a particular situation, do bear in mind that many of the general rules I'm going to tell you about are more generally applicable. Okay, so protein polymerization can generate force. Well, we need some kind of theoretical framework for understanding that. So I show you this. This is actually, I think, the best piece of sort of theoretical work that's been done in the field. This was done by a physical chemist named Carol Hill in 1982, this 125-page manifesto in the International Reviews of Cytology. And basically, the problem that they were trying to tackle doing this work was to just assemble a simple thermodynamic framework for understanding what are the limits on how much force you can generate using this kind of mechanism. And they started off with a set of very simple circumstances where they said, okay, let's treat this polymerization reaction as being just a simple binding reaction, which physical chemists know how to deal with, where you have a filament and a monomer, and the reaction is the monomer binds to the end of the filament to generate a filament that's one subunit longer. So like any other binding reaction, there's an on rate and an off rate, there's some equilibrium constant. Now in a cell, it turns out that there's always excess monomer. So the forward reaction is always favored. In other words, delta G, Gibbs free energy, is always negative for the polymerization reaction for actin. Okay. In biology, it's a general principle that when you liberate free energy from a favorable chemical reaction, you can couple it to an unfavorable chemical reaction and drive the unfavorable reaction forward. That's basically the way that all of metabolism works. In this particular case, what we're going to do with the free energy is instead of coupling it to a chemical reaction, we're going to couple it to a mechanical reaction, which is moving the object. So consider the filament now nailed down at one end, and in our real case, the end is nailed down because it's attached to all the other filaments in the comet tail. And then at the end of that growing filament impinges a movable load, and here our movable load is the bacterium. And basically, you can calculate, knowing the properties of the load, how much work does it take, how much force through distance does it take to move the load, the distance that it takes to insert one more monomer. And as long as that amount of work is less than or equal to the free energy that was liberated by the polymerization reaction, then the overall reaction is favored, the polymerization will go forward, and the load will move. And using this very simple argument, Terrell Hill then calculated the maximum amount of force that could be generated based on this system. And if you plug in the numbers for actin into this equation, basically you come up with the theoretical prediction that a single growing actin filament should be able to generate on the order of 5 piconewtons of force, which is good. That's exactly the same amount of force that a myosin motor can generate. Now this is purely an upper limit, it's a thermodynamic limit, and it makes certain simplifying assumptions. But certainly as far as it goes, it says this is a good source of energy, and unsurprisingly, anytime you have a useful source of energy, some biological system will have evolved to take advantage of it. The problem with this theoretical framework is that because it's a thermodynamic argument, it's an equilibrium assumption, we can't make any predictions about speed from this. And certainly what you immediately gather when you start looking at this phenomenon, watching the bacteria moving around inside of cells, is that speed is interesting. They go really fast, and they go really quite disturbingly fast, because you would have a hard time thinking, knowing that thousands and thousands of those monomers have to bind in order for the bacteria to just move one micron. To get those kinds of speeds, something interesting has to be going on here that enables it to be so rapid. To give a little bit of a physical intuition about what this means, it's a counterintuitive kind of motor, right? It doesn't make any sense to work this way. I don't know if this is going to work for physicists, but biologists love this. Okay, so let's discuss scale. So the bacterium is 2 microns long, and a typical speed is about 0.2 microns per second. It takes 10 seconds to move one length. And it does this by piling up actin monomers that are only 4 nanometers in size behind it. So that's how fast that has to happen. And this happens at a Reynolds number on the order of around 10 to the minus 7th. So it's able to move essentially through concrete by piling up actin monomers behind it at this very, very rapid rate. Well, what would this mean if we get rid of the constraint of the Reynolds number and try to think about a macroscopic analogy? And if you look through the world and you try to find something that's got the same shape as a bacterium, what you find is the Ohio-class nuclear submarine, which is like the bacterium. It's a cylinder that's capped by hemispheres on each end, and it's got the same length-to-width ratio as Listeria. So for this nuclear submarine, it's 560 feet long, and a typical cruising speed is 30 feet per second. In other words, it takes 10 seconds to move one length, exactly the same as the bacterium. So if you scale up the bacterium to be the size of the submarine, the actin monomer would have to be a foot, or about the size of a basketball. So there's two things I think are interesting about that. One is that if you were in a satellite and you were watching submarines cruising around on the surface of the ocean, it would look exactly the same as the movie I just showed you of the bacteria. Second thing is, it means that that speed, and we have a physical intuition about what that means for a submarine to move at that kind of rate, that the submarine is doing essentially by grabbing basketballs out of the ocean and plugging them in behind itself. Okay? So this is the motor that we're talking about. So what do we understand? Well, for many years of biological research, basically we understand a lot about the cell biology of infection. We know what happens, we know what order they happen in, we know where, that kind of stuff. Fortunately now, we also understand the biochemistry. A lot of focus research from many labs over the last 10 years has identified every single protein that's necessary for the system to go, and we basically know what those proteins do. We also understand something about the organization. We know the dynamics, we can observe what happens. The reason that I'm here is because we don't understand the physics. Basically, we don't understand how assembling proteins can give force generation. We don't understand how this can happen to give such great speeds. We don't understand what controls things like, why did they go in a straight line but not perfectly in a straight line? They tend to curve to the right or the left. Well, how is that governed? How is that regulated? We don't understand how the tail is self-organized, how you get this structure many microns long from nanometer scale subunits by an action that happens just at the bacterial surface. And in particular, we don't understand how symmetry breaking occurs. How does a bacterium pick up and start moving? So what I want to share with you is some recent experiments that we've done that try to address these different questions purely from an experimental point of view. I will admit that we've decided that as a theoretical problem, it's too complicated for us to handle. But the bacterium is able to integrate all of the forces on its surface really very naturally, and it will move, and those are things that we can measure.
Can you say again what you mean by symmetry breaking? The bacteria does have a head and a tail, right?
It does. Let me hold off on answering that question for a couple of slides because I think it'll become clear.
Okay.
So the bacterium, in terms of the molecules, just has one protein that's important. This is the only protein besides actin that I want you to remember. It's called ACTA. And the bacterium does have a head and a tail. It puts the ACTA only on its tail, and that's the end that grows the comet tail. So in that sense, we can say the symmetry breaking problem isn't one to do with protein polymerization because the bacterium has already broken symmetry, and we should be studying that. And in fact, two of the people in my lab are studying that, but that's a different seminar. The host cell contributes all sorts of stuff, which we're not going to go into, but I show you this list just to prove that biochemists know what they're doing. This is a system we have a good molecular handle on, and we can regulate and control essentially every aspect of it. Now, this is what I mean by symmetry breaking. What happens, it turns out we can put this together from purified components. We can make it go in the lab. We can get it outside of the cell. And so if you take, in this case, it's just a cytoplasmic extract. It's just cell juice. And you drop in some of these bacteria. What happens is, first you put in the bacteria, and you don't see any actin filaments. Here, the actin protein has been labeled with a fluorescent molecule, so we can see where the filaments are directly. And this is actually a scene from a video. So this is things that are alive and happening in real time. So first off, you get no actin filaments. And then the second thing that happens, even though the bacterial protein is polarized, is actin filaments make a uniform cloud that's perfectly evenly distributed all over the bacterial surface. And bacteria with these clouds are not moving. And then something happens, and the cloud becomes rearranged to form this asymmetric comet tail, and bacteria with comet tails are moving. When one of these guys runs into something and it stops, the filaments in the comet tail go ahead and depolymerize, and it goes back to being a symmetrical cloud. So you can think of this as being a bistable system where you go from a symmetric cloud to a non-symmetric tail, moving and not moving, and the shape, the organization, is tightly coupled to the movement behavior. Okay.
Can you tell me about the medium in which it's moving? It's very viscous.
It is very viscous. This is cytoplasm that's been strained to make it less viscous than a real cell. But even so, it's on the order of about 150 centipoise.
Do you know if the bacteria is rotating?
Yes. In fact, it is. And that's coming up in a while. That's a big shock, actually, that it's rotating, because as we go through the mechanism of how it rotates is quite a big mystery, and there's no theory to address it. But the reality is that it's rotating. Okay. So somehow we go from here to here. This is the symmetry breaking that I want to address. But remember, the bacterial cell is very complex and it's already polarized and that kind of stuff. So we never are going to know, if we just watch bacteria start to move, whether what we're looking at is really a symmetry breaking in the interesting sense of really spontaneous organization of order. So in order to get a better defined system, we're able to look at that kind of thing explicitly and experimentally. What we've done is taken the bacterial protein and then attached it to little polystyrene spheres. And it turns out that when you do this, that's all you need, the little polystyrene spheres will essentially behave just like bacteria. So these are a couple of frames from a video sequence. Here you've got two of these ACTA-coated beads. One of them has a symmetrical cloud, and you'll see this one is not moving. And one of them has an asymmetrical comet tail, and you'll see this one is moving. And to show you what that really looks like, here's the plastic bead, and there's its actin comet tail. And you see it's exhibiting a lot of the same behaviors that the bacteria do. It's moving fairly persistently, but not perfectly. Every so often it makes a sharp turn. It's moving at a certain rate, which turns out to be exactly the same as bacteria would move in the system.
Comet tail connected to the bead?
It is, yes.
There's no growth.
Well, there's growth at the interface, even though it's connected. Mm-hmm. How that works, I can't tell you.
So this is not a life form. This is a artificial.
This is a piece of polystyrene.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And here, so one of the nice things also about the polystyrene is not only can we modify it and now do sort of physical experiments, but it's very easy for the computer to track. So here the computer is keeping track of where the beads are, and we put a little red dot to indicate for each one of those things. And this is, I mean, it's a party going on in there, right? I mean, these are not alive. These are pieces of plastic, but they're able to do this. So now under this kind of system, now we have a sphere, okay? And I know that you guys like to approximate things by a sphere, and here we have an actual sphere. And the sphere starts off uniformly coated with this protein. It nucleates actin polymerization, does it all over the surface, and we see they have clouds, and they sit there, and they're not moving. And then somehow this happens, and when this happens, it's persistent, and it acts like a bistable system. We don't know if it's random. We don't know if it's random. But we can't, the spheres are spherically symmetric in every aspect that we can measure. So if there's some unmeasured asymmetry,
medium
we wouldn't know it. The medium is homogeneous.
But how uniform is the coding?
The coding is actually quite uniform, at least again by as far as we're able to detect it. So when we look by light or electron microscopy, we can't detect.
So you're saying the symmetry is broken suddenly and moves in London.
That's right. And in fact, we can watch it. So Alex, so those movies I just showed you were gathered by Lisa Cameron, who's a graduate student in the lab who worked out this motility system. And at the time, we had a postdoc, Alexander Van Oudenaarde, who's trained as a physicist. And he looked at it and he said, no way. You know, there's got to be some trick to this. They can't possibly be symmetric and then break symmetry in this way. So he did this unbelievably boring experiment, which was he sat on the microscope and he watched beads that weren't moving that had these clouds, and he waited for them to start. And this is a very rare event, and he spent a week in the microscope and he got 8 events. And here I'll show you one of them. So this bead with a cloud is not going to start to move. This bead with the cloud is going to start to move. And you'll see there's some differences. You can see, or at least get the sense, that there's actin turnover here. And we can do some experiments to measure the kinetics. Yeah, so this is another bead that is independently moving and just happened on the scene. And in this particular movie, it seems coincidental that this fellow starts up when the other one comes in. But from other data, we know that that's just a coincidence. No, it's not. And actually, if you look closely, you can see right where this breaks symmetry there, it's before the other one gets to it. Which is not to say there's no influence, but it's not something that's regular. You know, it doesn't always happen that way. But one thing that you can see is that although this cloud, you know, it's dynamic, things are coming and going, there's some fluctuations, the fluctuations here seem to be qualitatively different. You have, the cloud looks like it's writhing around the bead. Every so often the bead makes a little hop within the cloud, and then at some point it gets to the edge of the cloud, and then it squirts off. And we can measure the speeds very precisely, and we know that when it squirts off, it's instantaneously moving at its top speed. There's no acceleration phase. It's either in its cloud or else it's broken symmetry and off it goes. Mm-hmm. So this is now something we can look at experimentally. So first thing...
After that event, it just kept going?
Just kept going. And then it left the field of view, so we don't know what happened to it later. But now we're doing this on plastic beads. We can now do experiments. So we can vary things like... how much protein we put on the surface of the bead. And this turns out to be pretty interesting. These are just some snapshots, so you can see the clouds and the tails. Remember, anything with a cloud is not moving, anything with a tail is moving. And it turns out as you increase the amount of protein that you put on the bead, there is an optimum amount. So if you put too much protein on the bead, you get fewer tails, and if you put too little protein on the bead, you get fewer tails. Somewhere in the middle is just about right. And this shows the quantitation of that. You can see it's a very, very steep dependence with a very clear optimum. So basically, this experiment is just to here. The plastic bead has a certain number. It's got a parking area, a certain number of binding sites for protein. And we can either put on ACTA, or else we can put on a protein that doesn't have any function. And so this is saying how many of those binding sites are actually the functional protein, and how many of them are just taking up space. So you know, in this kind of case, every place a protein could be its functional, and here it's only 10%. Okay.
So the number of sites is actually discrete. On the plastic bead, maybe the beads have been treated in some way.
In this particular experiment, they're not. Those types of things are possible to do. Here, though, the association actually is a non-specific association between the protein and the polystyrene, and we know how much area it takes up. Okay.
There's no evidence for Brownian motion in that picture, or are you tracking?
Oh well.
The bead itself is at rest, or are you tracking?
Yeah, so it's actually, so if you just put beads in something of this viscosity, you would be able to see Brownian motion by eye. Yeah. Once they get an acting cloud, the Brownian motion is substantially damped. It's sub-diffusive.
Do you know where exactly the proteins go? When you say 25%, do you exactly know?
So what we can, there are two things we can do. One is we can just look at the level of light. We can make the protein fluorescent and look at its distribution. And that, at the resolution level of light microscopy, is quite even. The other thing we can do is fix the cells and slice them and use an antibody to, or fix the beads and use an antibody to see where the protein is. And again, by that criterion, it's uniform. Mm-hmm. Not perfectly, but not enough to explain this kind of thing. Okay, so symmetry breaking is affected by protein density. However, if you take among all those different protein densities, you ask for the ones who are moving, how fast are they moving? Their speeds are identical. And their speeds are also identical to the speed of that real bacteria in the same system. So there's some different set of rules governing the process of symmetry breaking versus the process of steady state movement. They're affected by different parameters.
But that's very surprising, isn't it? Because the size of the plastic bead are that looks arbitrary, right? Suppose I use a bigger bead or a smaller bead, it would still be the same velocity.
Here are our bigger and smaller beads. Okay. So everything I showed you so far was half micron, which is very close to the diameter of the hemisphere on the bacterium. Turns out if we make smaller beads, they're much more likely to form tails. These guys actually move at very similar rates to the bigger ones. Once you get bigger than that, then you start seeing a size effect on speed. But the interesting thing is here, once you go to larger beads, you basically don't get tails anymore.
I see. But all the other guys have some universal velocity.
Yes.
The speed is universal.
Yes. Between 200 and 500 nanometers, the speed is universal. Mm-hmm. Once you start playing other tricks, you can get bigger things to move, then the speed slows down with size. Okay. We don't understand speed at all, actually. I have some stuff about that later on. Okay, so smaller beads are more likely to break symmetry and form tails, and here's the quantitation. This is a very nice steep drop-off, and you can fit it with pretty much any curve you choose, unfortunately. Okay, but here's an interesting thing. So how big are the bacteria? Well, the bacteria are 2 microns long, which would be out here, and they're 0.8 microns in diameter, which would be right here. So based on this analysis, the bacteria should never be able to do this spontaneously, right? So this is an interesting sort of explanation for the biological observation. The protein does end up on one side of the bacterium. Now we know it has to be on one side of the bacterium because otherwise it'd never be able to start moving. That suggests, that makes a prediction, which is that if we can make our plastic beads asymmetric, then we should be able to get bigger plastic beads to start moving too.
The bacteria can start moving when they make themselves thinner or thicker like this, and that will initiate the movement. They form themselves into
Yeah, so bacteria, certainly gram-positive bacteria, which is this class, they essentially don't deform. They have a very, very thick, rigid cell wall, and they have a uniform diameter. They'll get longer, but they'll never get thinner. But if they could do that, that might make a difference. And I'll show you some experiments later on where we do that sort of artificially. No, actually, we haven't found a satisfactory way to do that. Because polystyrene works great for this purpose and other materials simply don't work as well. And it's very hard to know whether the reason they don't work as well is because of a biochemical change on the surface or because of other things. What we'd love to have would be half micron diameter polystyrene beads that have a little chunk of lead in the middle. And we just haven't found a satisfactory prep of those kinds of things. Okay, so we want to make our beads asymmetric and see if that'll solve the size problem. So Matt Footer did an experiment where he took latex microspheres and dispersed them on a glass slide and then put them in a vacuum evaporator and evaporated glass onto the beads. So basically, these are now little plastic beads that are wearing a little glass beanie. And the protein sticks much better to the plastic than it does to the glass. So as you can see up here, when we label the protein, make it fluorescent, we can actually get protein mostly on one side, which is the free plastic, and it's basically absent from the side with glass. And when we do that, now we can get big, giant beads to move. Okay? So great. So the symmetry breaking can be imposed by making a large enough bead asymmetric. But still, this argues that, you know, based on what I've shown you so far, beads that are 500 nanometers or smaller, you don't have to do this too. They're able to do it spontaneously, and it's got something to do with those nonlinear actin dynamics that we see in the clouds right before they start moving.
Now you see a big drop in velocity.
Yes, once you get above 1 micron, you see a big drop in velocity, but not until then. And that holds up now. We've figured out other tricks to get bigger and bigger things to move, and once you get into that size range, then there is an effect.
Is there a mathematical model for how this
Okay. There's a simulation, which is not quite the same as a model, but I'll show you the simulation. So in order to come up with a simulation, what we need to do is try to say, make a guess about what the force-generating elements are. And I told you that what happens in this form of motility is that you have a polymer that gets longer and a movable wall moves forward. And what I skipped over, because it's not known, is what's the process that enables space to open up so the monomer can sneak in. You can imagine several different things. There's lots of thermal motion in the system. The filaments are moving, they're fluctuating in length, the bacterium is moving, all that kind of stuff. It turns out if you look at all the elements that are known to move, the thing that moves the most is the filament bends sideways. And the bending modulus of actin has been measured physically. It's pretty well known. And Alex McGillner and George Oster wrote a model where they took the known bending modulus of actin and association-dissociation contents, things like that, a very realistic model. And they calculated, you know, how much time would it take for a monomer to sneak on, and could that support the rates that we see? And the answer turns out to be yes. If this is the only thing that's moving thermally, that happens fast enough and efficiently enough that that can explain the rates.
You haven't told us how the thing is attached to the wall, so that thing, that the attachment has to break and reattach.
Yes, that's right. The observation is that if you go in with like an optical trap and you try to pull the bacterium or the bead away from its tail, you can't. So there are attachments, and we can make attempts to measure the strength. But we don't know how it's attached. So what we think is that in the tail you have 1,000 filaments that are all impinging on the surface. If 200 of them are attached, that'll be a real rigid attachment. The other 800 in the meantime can be pushing. Now, those other 800, though, are pushing, you know, they're bending and they're growing and that kind of thing. And so they're building up sort of an elastic pressure. And then some of those will reattach, and then the old attachments will break, and so you'll be able to sort of cycle through it like that. Mm-hmm. At least that's, it's a working hypothesis. This is the bacterium. This is essentially the rest of the comet tail, where it's just all the filaments are nailed to each other, and then they're attached to structures in the cell.
Okay, and they're attached to each other as just a whole
protein? Yes, yes.
Is this attachment
preserved
when it's coming
to
the next cell?
So that again is a whole different seminar. It turns out some of the actin goes with it, and as you go into the next cell, several things happen. The membrane-bound compartment gets acidified. The acidification of the membrane-bound compartment actually activates certain enzymes that are in the bacterium to go and destroy everything else that's in the vesicle. So each time the bacterium goes into a new cell, it destroys all of its act A, it gets rid of all its motility apparatus, and it comes out, you know, clean as a newborn babe into the next cell. And then the whole thing begins again. It takes three generations before it's able to start moving. It's mostly in the form of monomers, but if you do a fractionation, you can always find some small filaments, and it's not totally clear, you know, which of those forms actually is most important. Certainly for elongation, monomers are more necessary, but it's not possible to do an experiment to say that the small filaments aren't also necessary. Okay? Okay, so this is the best sort of detailed model we have for single filament from Alex and George, and so what Alexander did next was he decided to try to apply that elastic Brownian ratchet model to the problem of symmetry breaking and see if we could actually try to simulate some of the phenomenology we're seeing in the biological system. So Alexander wrote a very simple model. First off, he did a two-dimensional simplification, so this is a circle instead of a sphere. And he started off with, for the ones I'm going to show you, 50 filaments around the outside of the sphere, which is realistic for most of the experiments that we're actually doing. And he modeled each of these independently as being a Brownian ratchet, an elastic Brownian ratchet that bends like that. And basically, in each round of the simulation, you have to make a decision whether to add a subunit to the filament, and you have to make a decision whether to lose a subunit to the filament. And to simplify the calculations, we essentially collapsed all of the biochemical considerations into the off rate and all of the geometrical considerations into the on rate, but this is just purely for calculation purposes. And the important part here is that he made the assumption that if the filament end is exactly one subunit width away from the surface, then polymerization will be favored and you will get a monomer added. If it's too close to the surface, then it has to bend in order for a monomer to get added. And you can calculate very precisely what the probability of it bending far enough just from Boltzmann's distribution. If it gets too far away from the surface, because biochemical details I don't want to go into will enable elongation only close to the surface, if you get too far away, you also won't grow.
What is X again in that picture?
X.
X.
Oh, here? X. Oh, this is the distance from the tip of the filament to the surface of the bead. Okay. For each of the filaments. And so you go through one round. Some of the filaments add, some of the filaments lose, some of them do nothing. And the ones that have added now are pushing on the bead. And so then you do an energy minimization, calculate the new centroid position of the bead, and then you iterate thousands and thousands of times. Okay, so what happens? Well, it depends very strongly on the biochemical parameters. So if we make the biochemical parameters such that filaments are much more likely to grow than they are to shrink, that is, they're 50 times more likely to add a subunit than lose a subunit, then what you get is a very constrained random walk. And if you compare how far this simulated beat actually goes to something with the same distribution of step sizes as in a true random walk, you can see it's subdiffusive, it's constrained in the actin cloud. And that fits in very well with what we see experimentally. Once the thing grows its actin, Brownian motion gets very strongly damped. The cool thing happens when you change the value of this subunit, or the value of this constant. So now instead of having the filaments be 50 times more likely to grow than shrink, we make them only 5 times more likely to grow than shrink. And here, now notice this change in scale. So what happens is the bead sits there, twiddles around for a little while, just like that. And then suddenly it will break symmetry, it'll go off in this long, persistent random walk. It'll lose it, it'll twiddle around again, and it'll do it again and walk off. And so with this very, I mean, almost laughably simple simulation, we've actually gotten a lot of the interesting phenomenology that we see in the biological system. And you can do things like look at, you know, what's the dispersion as a function of time given different values of this parameter. And it turns out that sort of regardless of the values of the parameter, you start off in a subdiffusive state. But then for certain ones, which I can make an argument are biologically relevant ones, you go through a point where you then break over into directed motion. And this shows the simulation. And this shows from the 8 events that Alexander was able to actually capture on the microscope. Again, scale to the active monomer size, this shows the movements within the cloud immediately prior to symmetry breaking. So,
well,
it's not set, the calculation is not set up in a way that we could actually see tails. Because certainly when you form a real tail, there's also a profound rearrangement of the way the filaments are attached to each other. And Alexander didn't deal with that in his simulation. He was only looking at the surface events. So no, but they wouldn't be able to under these conditions. A cool thing that he found. Sorry?
After this happens, the end of the process, the tail's already there.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's right. So that's certainly a way in which the model does not capture the reality of the system. But there are many. this I think is particularly interesting. He also looked at what's your dispersion after 2000 iterations as a function of this critical variable, this p-off. And it turns out there's an optimum. Okay, if it's in the middle, you'll actually get further than if there's too little or too much. And likewise, the amount of force, the maximum amount of force that the bead feels at any instant in time during the trajectory also goes through a maximum, an optimum. The reason we found this so intriguing was because this result I showed you before, where the likelihood of movement initiation, that is the probability that it's going to get up enough oomph to break out of its cloud and start moving, also has a clear optimum. And that p-off value, that's essentially the ratio between actin polymerization, actin depolymerization, and that is governed by the concentration of the protein on the surface. So biochemically, we're able to demonstrate essentially that same sort of optimization. If you look at a little more detail, you can see that what's really going on here is that the fact that all the filaments are interacting with the same bead couples the dynamic behavior of different filaments in such a way that if you look at this toy version of the model where there's only 2 filaments, and you look at the cross-correlation between the distance of the first one and the distance of the second one, that cross-correlation is strongly dependent on the physical separation of the filaments. So for 2 filaments that are close to each other, there's a negative cross-correlation. And for 2 filaments that are far apart from each other, you know, where one is essentially on the other side of the bead, there's a positive cross-correlation. Or in other words, when this filament adds a subunit, it nudges the bead a little bit forward, and that makes it easier for this filament to add a subunit. It goes hand over hand. On the other hand, if the filament's on the other side, and this filament adds a subunit, it nudges the bead closer to the other filament, makes it harder for it to do it. So you have short-range positive feedback, long-range negative feedback, and that, together with some other aspects of coupling in the system, enable fluctuations, stochastic fluctuations in actin dynamics to sometimes get amplified to the point where you can get this large-scale symmetry breaking. Okay, nice model. How do we test if it's true or not? Well, what we really want to do is measure the force at the interface between the comet tail and the cargo and see if the amount of force that we measure there is consistent with this kind of model. So Paolo Giardini came up with a fairly clever way of doing this, which is instead of using a rigid bacterium or a rigid bead, to use a deformable particle and let deformation of the particle be the way that we could read out what the forces were at the surface. So it turns out the easiest way to do this is to make phospholipid vesicles and coat them with their protein. And here the phospholipids have been labeled green and the actin again is red. And this movie's going to loop back again in a second. But what you can see is that as this vesicle with its comet tail is moving in this environment, it also is being deformed. So when we start off here, it's sort of round, then it gets very teardrop shaped, then it gets very elongated into an ellipsoid. Here it slows down and gets very, very distorted. Then it sort of oozes out of this cloud of actin and becomes teardrop shaped again and moves off. And looking at many of these, we were able to see that, in fact, that deformation is characteristic. It's totally due to actin. When you have the same kinds of vesicles with no actin, they're either spherical or ellipsoidal. And so that's this population over here. Whereas when you have actin on them, they become deformed into a teardrop shape, and that's this population down here. So it's entirely actin dependent.
These vesicles are organic or inorganic objects?
Well, they're made out of biological phospholipids. They're actually made out of egg lipids, and they're coated with the bacterial protein. So they're organic.
But they don't have any action of them on their own?
No, there's all that's inside of them is sugar water.
Yeah.
It's just the thing that's nice about them is they're deformable, and also the surface is fluid. So it's just a physically different thing than we were dealing before with a rigid, non-fluid surface. Okay. So in other words, what happens is you grow an actin tail, and the actin tail is squeezing on the vesicle in order to give you this teardrop shape.
Is
Yeah, that is. That's a little tubule of lipid that's going right down the core of the tail. And they'll often persist like that for quite a long time. But if the thing stops and the tail deforms, the lipid tubule gets sucked back in. So it's being held out there by interactions with the actin. Okay. Now, this was sort of a surprise to us when we saw it. But it turns out that there was a French theoretical group led by Jacques Pro, which had predicted that under these kinds of geometrical circumstances, you would in fact get an inward squeezing force generated by the comet tail. And their argument is very simple and very elegant. They ignore anything about the molecular details of how this grows. And they just say, let's forget about actin filaments, let's forget about monomers and all that kind of stuff, and let's just say it's an elastic gel, and that elastic gel is growing somehow only at the surface of the cylindrical object. So as the thing is moving, and this is only a steady state model, as the thing is moving, the gel is growing, but it's cylindrical. And so as the gel is growing at the surface of the cylinder, stress accumulates out on the outside. And as you go further and further back in the bacterium, that stress gets more and more. But now you get back to the nice end of the bacterium, which is this pretty little hemisphere, and now the stress can be relieved by the gel squeezing inward. In other words, you have a frictional force from attachment out here, and then right at the back you have an inward squeezing force which pushes the thing forward like a watermelon seed. And so this is really, you know, this model, without any molecular details, actually predicted that observation that we had. So now, one nice thing about vesicles is there are many people in the world who tug on phospholipid bilayers and bend them and have measured very, very carefully how much energy it takes to do that. So we can use the actual degree of deformation of this phospholipid vesicle to estimate the total amount of pressure on the surface that you would need in order to get that deformation. And when you do that in a sort of quasi-static model, what you estimate is that the total force that's being generated on the surface is on the order of 3 nanonewtons, which is a lot. It's particularly a lot when you think about, well, how much force would it take to overcome hydrodynamic drag to move through something of this viscosity. Just to get over the hydrodynamic drag, it would be 100 femtonewtons. So we've got 5 orders of magnitude more force here, between 4 and 5, more force than we need to move. Okay? And most of that force is not in the direction of motion. Most of that force is inward, squeezing the vesicle, which seems really fairly inefficient. Well, another thing that's interesting is you'll notice if you look at the distribution of the force vectors here that most of the force is on the sides, and there's actually very little force back here at the end. But this is where the comet tail is. This is actually where all the actin is. And if you think about detailed filament models, to a first approximation, the amount of total force being generated should scale with the actin density. So if we measure the actin density and then we make an assumption, this is a big assumption, but if we make the assumption that these normal force vectors that we calculate based on the deformation is only one component of a vector that could be going in any direction, we can use the actin distribution to set the magnitude and this component to set the direction, then we can calculate or at least estimate the total force that's being generated going in all directions. And what we find is almost all of the force is inward rather than in the direction of motion. There's actually a slight rearward component to the force, which is a surprise. And it really does look like the thing is being squeezed. And one thing that's particularly interesting about this in light of those tubules is that basically what's going on here is everything is squeezing in. Right at the back of the vesicle here, you have an enormous amount of force that's not really doing anything. It's just sort of squeezing in on the tail. But if a little bit of the lipid gets caught back here, it'll hold onto it and sort of extract it, just like milking a cow. So those experiments have shown us a couple of things. One, that there's a very large squeezing force, an inward squeezing force, and that seems to be the major force that's generated by the comet tail. And also that under circumstances where we have a deformable particle, the formation of an actin comet tail will affect particle shape. So it seems natural to flip that question around and say, well, does shape then also affect the comet tail formation? Does it go in both directions? And if you think, at least macroscopically and sort of naively, which is how I think, about squeezing on a particle like this. And you start off with an ellipsoidal bead now instead of a round bead, and you squeeze and squeeze and squeeze on it. You can easily imagine that having a tail growing off the long axis would be unstable, because as you squeeze it, it'll tend to flip around, whereas something going that way will be stable. And although bacteria are sort of this shape, they also have all this polarity and this kind of stuff, so it's an unfair test to say that this is true because the bacteria always have this orientation. What we really want is a polystyrene particle, which is ellipsoidal, where we can uniformly code it and do all the nice controls and all that kind of stuff, and really see, is there a preference? The model seems to suggest this should be the preference. So we found a wonderful group of material scientists at the University of Washington, led by Yunnan Xia, who deform polystyrene for a living. And one of the shapes that they can make is ellipsoids. So they sent us some of these ellipsoidal polystyrene particles. We coated them with ACTA and Paul set up a motility assay. And you'll see, interestingly enough, they can move in any orientation. So like this fellow here is moving parallel to his long axis, just like a bacterium, but its neighbor is moving perpendicular to its long axis. It's moving the wrong way. They're all uniformly coated. Okay, so quantitation. Turns out if you look at the yaw angle, so the angle between the long axis of the ellipsoidal bead and the direction of motion, that there are essentially two preferred orientations. It's perfectly happy to move parallel to its long axis, the normal way, but it's also perfectly happy, in fact, it prefers even a little bit to move perpendicular to its long axis. It's very unhappy in the middle. You don't find a lot of ones that are moving diagonally. When we do see ones that are moving diagonally, they're almost always flipping over from one to the other. But really, both of these things are perfectly fine. Okay, so they're both stable. What about the amount of force? There has to be some difference, right? Well, we can't really directly measure force on these because they're not deformed, but what we can do is measure speed. And since this is such low Reynolds number, we can make a statement that the speed at any instant time has to be the summation of the forces that are acting on that particle. And when we look at the speeds, they are bang on, absolutely identical. It's got no dependence at all on orientation of the bead. We cannot explain this result. And this is a very good example of why we need more theorists to get interested in this kind of problem.
But this speed is different from the universal speed that you showed us earlier.
Well, it's not quite a fair comparison because this is done in a different biochemical background. If we take a bacterium and put it in the same background, it would actually come down to the same speed.
Oh, really?
It's unbelievably difficult to mess with the speed. Wow. It really is. We can do it biochemically. We can change protein concentrations. That'll change the speed. But in terms of physical parameters, we basically not found any physical parameters that will change the speed, with the sole exception of very large sizes.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, none of this theorizing had anything to do with curvature.
That's right, yeah. So that, I'll get to that in a second. We don't have a good model for the curvature. There have been some attempts made in the literature by other people to predict what kind of curvature you would get, but the models so far have been, in a way, sort of too detailed to be useful, in that they've assumed a certain series of biochemical events which we know are not accurate. That is also an assumption, and the truth is we don't have good data to prove that. We know within the limits of light microscopy, so we know things happen within 200 nanometers of the surface, but we don't know things happen at the surface, and that's a very important distinction, but there are no experiments yet that distinguish that. So you can imagine a class of models where all the filaments of the surface are attached, and the important growth actually happens in the gel at some distance, and I think that's very possible.
In speeds, they also show some curvy paths.
Yes.
Is the size of that curvature related to the
tail? Yes, and that's the only thing that's different between these two guys. These guys go straighter. The fatter tail goes straighter. Was there another question?
Yeah, how big are
these? This particular batch is 2 microns long and 900 nanometers in diameter, so it's very close to bacterial size.
So those guys have bigger tails?
Yeah, they have fatter tails.
Fatter.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you expect the skin to be somewhat self-limiting? If you go too fast, then you lose your tail.
Well, so
that. So
yeah, now, but the tail is attached, right? And so what we're really asking when we're asking speed is how fast is the tail growing? But it can't grow quicker than the thing that's causing it to grow. You see what I mean?
So that's
Yeah, but the interesting result here is that the surface is not limiting. And when you think in detail about, you know, this whole story I tried to sell you going back 20 years to Terrell Hill of polymers that are nudging up against barriers and all that kind of thing, the barrier should matter. The nature of the barrier should matter, the physical surface should matter, the curvature should matter. All these experiments say none of those things matter, and we don't know why.
When you say the tail is attached, I was confused. I thought the analogy of the model was that it was attached to the rest of the tail, but the filaments are anchored in the network, and then they will not be attached to that tail.
Yeah, so some of them probably are not attached to the bacterium, but some of them probably are, and they probably can go back and forth. Because there are, you know, certainly there are well-defined biochemical mechanisms by which the actin filament will have an affinity for the surface. But the surface is completely covered in binding sites. They're all weak binding sites. So it's very likely that it's coming on and off and is able to bind different places. Okay? Anything else? Okay. Okay, so this was the previous question. So part of the deal here is I tried to set you up with some pretty simple models and pretend that we understood the physics of it to at least a first approximation. The truth is we don't, because first off, we show most of the force is not normal to the surface, it's squeezing inward. And really any of those models where you have fluctuating filaments that are knocking on a surface, the only direction of force transduction would have to be normal to the surface. We know it's not all normal because the squeezing result I showed you. Here's another result showing that it's not all normal. We do have torque. What you're looking at here is a bacterium, and this is now in a more complex system that's a lot more like a real cell. And on this bacterium, they're attached two little fluorescent polystyrene beads right up at the front like headlights. And what you see, if you look particularly over here, is you'll see one bead, then two beads, then one bead, then two beads, then one, then two, one, two, one, two, et cetera, okay? And the reason you're seeing this is because the bacterium is rifling, it's rotating, and you see the beads go behind each other and then come back again. And this is a very difficult experiment to do. So our numbers are fairly small, and it's very difficult to measure the period of the rotation because it's very slow. Yeah, it's rifling around the long axis. And so this says that filaments on the surface are also generating torque, which does not fit in with any of these models.
How massive is the tail compared to the mass of the
bead? It's probably about 10 times more massive, but it's not moving. Oh, the bead.
The tail
is more massive than the particle. Yeah, but the tail is also stuck to things, so it's cross-linked to other cytoskeletal structures, and it's immobile not because of its mass, but rather because of attachments. We can't do this experiment on beads because the way that the little polystyrene particles are stuck on depends on a bacterial interaction. We're trying. I would love to know. Who's going to bet that the beads are also going to rotate? So the question was, no, these are bacteria. This is the real
bacteria,
the real beast. Yeah, the little spots are tiny beads. They're a few nanometers. Okay. Now this is good. So here's the experiment. We're going to try to do the same thing on beads. We haven't done the experiment yet, so I don't know the outcome. And see if the beads also rotate while they're doing this. Who's going to bet that they do? Okay. Who's going to bet that they don't? Okay, interesting. So it's an experiment worth doing, it sounds like. Can anybody come up with a mechanism for how they can be rotating?
Well, it's
not sure.
It depends on the rotation.
But how... Oh, I see.
Is the chirality almost the same?
Unfortunately, we can't tell the chirality because the optical plane is thicker than the size of the bacterium, so we can't tell the difference. We're trying to set up to see chirality. We can tell that it's unidirectional in the sense that they don't switch once they start going, but that doesn't address the chirality problem. From other experiments, I think it's a 90% chance that the chirality is always the same.
Can the two beads be somehow different colors when you're attaching?
Yeah, that would be a good thing to try to do. So we haven't done that yet. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, it's very complicated. And what we want to do is get, you know, a microscopic handle on how it is really that this is working. We need to be able to dissect these complex mechanics, and we need to do it at the molecular level if we really want to get a satisfying explanation. So although we're not there yet, one thing that I would like to leave you with is the realization that this is a particularly powerful system because the biochemistry and molecular biology is very, very well in hand. And what we have the potential to do is combine the sort of biophysical experiments I've just been showing you with the well-established and mature molecular biology of the system. In particular, these are bacteria and we can make mutants, and we can make as many mutants as we want. And we have a lot of site-directed mutants in this protein where we changed one amino acid or a few amino acids. We've got a collection now of about 60 of them, and some of them have mechanical phenotypes. And I'm just going to show you my two favorites. So here, this is a cell that's infected with bacteria, wild-type bacteria. And if you watch them moving around, you know, this should look very familiar to now. There's some curvature to the paths, there's some persistence, there's some element of a random walk, but they're sort of stately and calm in terms of their curvature. If we take this particular mutant, and this happens to be a mutant where two amino acids are changed in the protein, so it's a very subtle change, we put them into cells, what we see is this. They go in tight little circles. And even the ones that go pretty straight go a lot more jiggly than the ones over here. Okay, so now we don't yet know exactly what's wrong with the protein in terms of its biochemical function, but you can see how we will be able to go biochemically and say, this mutation changes the affinity of this protein for its particular binding partner by X amount, and the consequence of that is this mechanical behavior.
Does it change it, how infectious it is?
It does, yes. These are much less virulent.
I see.
Probably because when they get to the edge of the cell, they're kind of wiggly, they're not determined, and so they have trouble getting into the next cell.
Okay. So those are the good guys who want.
Yeah, these are the, oh. Yeah, unfortunately there's no competition, right? I mean, the bad guys can never wipe out. The good guys. Okay, this is my absolute fave. This is skidding. What happens is the bacterium is going to move along, and then the front end slows down, the back end keeps going. And so it looks just like a car that spins out on ice, pauses, takes off in another direction. And the one to watch here is this. It'll play through a couple of times. Okay, so it goes around, skid, skid. And you see that in trajectory with these sharp corners. Here it goes a little slower. Skid, skid. Okay. This one's even more dramatic. This is the edge of the cell right here, so this is actually a barrier that it's going to have trouble going through. So it gets to the barrier, skid, 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 skid. Needless to say, the wild type ones never do this. This is the same.
Do you think evolution has just wiped these guys out?
Yeah. This is the same mutant, and this is in a cell line where we've actually fused the green fluorescent protein to actin, so we can watch tail dynamics and bacterial movement in real time in living cells. And here what you can see is what happens is when the bacteria skid, the whole tail sort of slides around to the side and grows off the side and looks like those polystyrene beads that were growing with the tail in the wrong direction. But what's interesting about this is it's very reversible and it's very dynamic. It's really, you know, the skid is a temporary process. It sort of looks like the whole tail moves around. So I think if we understood how this works, we'd really understand a lot more about the force generation mechanism than we do.
This is amazing. This is changing 2 amino acids out of how many?
Out of 637.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The skidding is 5 amino acids. It's a charge to alanine scan. Okay, well, I set you up at the beginning to say this is going to teach us about cell crawling. Well, I just got one more set of movies to show. We're just beginning to try to do these same types of things in whole cells. And in particular for cell motility, what we chose was a cell type that moves very rapidly and very efficiently with persistent polarity. So we wouldn't, you know, the neutrophil that I showed you at the beginning is sort of all over the place. It's very complex. We want something that's as simple as possible to start with. So what we use are cells from the skin of the Nicaraguan cichlid. And this actually is our personal fish. His name is Nick. And it's a nice culture to do because the way that you get these skin cells is you take the fish, you pluck off a scale, and then you put the fish back in the tank. And it'll grow a new scale. And it's mad at you, but not very. So you can get these beautiful cultures of primary cells. So they're healthy. They're fresh off the fish. You know, everything is normal about these cells. It's not like a cell culture line. And as you see, the motility is very, very good. In this particular cell type, what happens is it carries its nucleus and all of its organelles, sort of all of its goodies, in a little package. And then the whole front, this big sort of canoe-shaped thing, is the lamellipodium. So this is a two-dimensional sheet of actin. And the organization of the actin, this two-dimensional sheet, is just a generalized version of the organization of actin, the comet tail. It's like a big spread-out comet tail. Okay? And the dynamics are very similar. You have growth of the actin at the front edge, then depolymerization of the actin at the back edge, and that goes on cyclically to move the cell forward. So we can measure speed, and now we can do things like change temperature, and you know that's a whole area of investigation. The thing I want to leave you with, which I think is a powerful analogy, is that we can study these same kinds of symmetry breaking issues. So everybody I showed you before was polarized, they're persistent, they move in one direction. But we can trick these cells into forgetting which way they're supposed to be going, and then they're quite non-motile. And an interesting analogy to the bacterial case, when they're non-motile, they're circularly symmetrical, so this is equivalent to the cloud. And when they're moving, they're polarized. They got a lamellipodium on one side but not the other, which is like the tail. And these guys, you know, they're highly dynamic. They're trying to crawl in all directions simultaneously because they're trying to crawl in all directions simultaneously. They don't get anywhere. Mm-hmm. So this is symmetry. And somehow it's possible to switch from this symmetrical non-motile state to an asymmetrical polarized motile state. So this is, again, a large-scale symmetry breaking. There's two ways they can do it. One is illustrated by this little fellow. He's sitting there minding his own business, circularly symmetrical. There's fluctuations and all that kind of thing. But now, wham, another cell runs into it. That polarizes the first cell, and now it picks up, and now it's going to go off forever. Okay? So polarization can be induced from the outside. And Gary Boris's lab has shown they can get the same kind of thing if they go in with a little micropipette and just sort of tickle the back of the cell. So really, any kind of physical perturbation will make the cell pick up and polarize. Okay? So that's got to be some kind of amplification. But the thing that I think is most fascinating is that if you sit there and watch them long enough, every so often one of those guys will just decide to pick up and move on its own. And now we're getting to the point where we know enough about the molecules and the dynamics that are involved in this kind of lamellipodial motility that we can now query, go in and ask particular components of the system, are they fluctuating, you know, where is the symmetry being really being broken in the cell at the molecular level? So this is very early days on this. I don't have any actual conclusions. But I think you can see that the hope is that we can take these kinds of combination of biophysical and biochemical approaches to really get at questions, satisfying questions in biological contexts. So finally, to summarize, I told you about this organism, Listeria monocytogenes, the turkey organism, that causes uses force generation generated by actin polymerization for infection spread. It's actin filament growth at the bacterial surface that contributes to force generation. The mechanism of this, the physical mechanism, is the thing that is now the big open question. We know there are many different types of force that are generated. There are propulsive forces. There's also friction, as I mentioned. There's the squeezing force that we can see on deformable objects, and there's torque that we can see in the rifling. And there are cooperative actin filament dynamics that will lead to large-scale symmetry breaking because of the coupling between the biochemistry of polymerization and the force that they are generated. And then finally, we're hoping to be able to get it mechanistically at this in more detail using mutations in the bacterial ACTA protein, where we can find mechanical phenotypes, including skidding and the going in tight circles, which we like to refer to as doing donuts. And basically, what we're trying to do is put together biological toolkits for mechanical problems. And in particular, the ones that I find most fascinating have to do with this dynamic, large-scale self-organization. For actin polymerization-based motility, the bacterial movement is a great place to start. It's simple, it's geometrically well-defined, it's stereotyped, and it's something we can do good physical experiments on. But whole cell movement is going to be the next frontier. So I want to conclude by acknowledging the very talented group of postdocs and graduate students in my lab who did all of the experiments where I showed you data today. Lisa Cameron developed the bead motility system initially, and Alexander van Oudenaarden worked on symmetry breaking with the beads. Paula Giardini has picked up that project with ellipsoidal beads and vesicles, and Dan Fletcher has helped with physical modeling of the vesicles. Fred Sue has worked out large-scale data collection techniques that I haven't gone through in detail, but have underlined basically everything you've seen. Jen Robbins is studying rifling. Susan Rafalski is studying the skidding mutants. And Patricia Yam is one of two new students in the lab who's beginning to work with fish skin cells. All of the Listeria strains that we use were generated by Dan Portnoy's lab at UC Berkeley. And in particular, the two favorite mutants that I showed you were made by his graduate student, Pete Lauer. And finally, Yudan Shah generated ellipsoidal beads with the help of his graduate student, Zulu. So that's it. Thanks.
Some questions? Lars?
Is there some reason you haven't used just the Stokes' law of drag to measure the force? Since you've got the velocity, you know the size of the particle, you know the viscosity of the medium.
There is. It doesn't work. We can do many types of experiments to vary the viscosity, and the one that is most convincing, I think, is when we actually do it in a cell in a biological context. As I mentioned, there are many different types of filamentous structures in the cell, and one that's completely dispensable is intermediate filaments. A lot of organisms don't have them, flies don't have them. You can make a mutant mouse where you get rid of the intermediate filaments from most of its cells and it's fine. It blisters easily, but it's otherwise fine. So if you take those cells and you compare them, so it's missing one kind of filamentous structure in the cytoplasm. You take those cells and compare them to wild-type cells, and you put in bacteria and you measure what's the effective viscosity. The effective viscosity for unconstrained Brownian motion of the bacteria has changed by a factor of 3. Now, you put in bacteria that can make comet tails, you ask, has the speed also changed by a factor of 3? No, the speed is bang on identical. The variation in speed has changed. The distribution is broader in the absence of the constraining intermediate filaments. So if you lower viscosity, variability goes up, but the speed stays the same. If you do a rough calculation to say how, given the amount of monitor that we have present, and Terrell Hill's calculation to say what's the maximum amount of force you could get out of that compared to the amount of force that we actually measure, it's unfortunately we have to make a lot of assumptions. So I can't give you an exact answer. It's on the order of 10% to 50% efficient. Not more than 50%, but probably not less than 10. It's not bad, actually. I mean, that's pretty good for biological motor.
Ours question is really, if you take this estimate of the force and calculate the velocity using Stokes' law.
Oh, I see. No. The amount of force that you need to move at the observed speed is four orders of magnitude less than the amount of force that we actually have. So we have, I mean, basically it's like, you know, it's got the, yeah, so it's got this, I'm sorry, I don't know, sorry. You know, here's the bacterium, it's totally rigid. The tail is squeezing it like this. Almost all of the energy is doing this, and then a tiny bit is moving it forward.
Well, I presume you're doing other things, like the torque.
Yeah, exactly. So when I say efficiency, what I'm talking about is total force generated. Efficiency of translating that force into forward movement is abysmal.
Yeah,
is 4 orders of magnitude.
4 orders of magnitude.
So the movement is a small part of what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Other questions?
So why is it so inefficient?
Well, there's several possible answers to that. One is that remember, this is a parasitic system. It's a bacterium that's, you know, living in a host cell. It's wasting the resources of the host cell. It doesn't care. Okay.
Someone else is paying.
However, it's also true that that energy is cheap in biological systems. I mean, you'll sometimes hear people try to make arguments that, you know, a cell is doing something such and such a way to conserve ATP or anything like that. There's no data to ever back up that kind of statement. ATP, it's just raining down. It's totally abundant. It's totally free. There's nothing, basically, in biology that's limited by energy. Why is this particular system, you know, got so much in the squeezing and so little in the propulsion? I think the answer to that has to do with stability, okay? Because the cell is very complex. There's all these organelles. Things are moving around. And the bacterium wants to move straight, and it wants to get out to the cell surface, and then it has to push its way through a cortex and into a neighboring cell. So it doesn't care how fast it gets there, but it cares that it goes straight. And so a lot of this excess energy may be to prevent perturbations in the environment from affecting the direction. And one set of experiments we started doing recently is looking at how movement of the bacteria inside a cell affects the behavior of organelles. And it's very easy to look at mitochondria. They're, you know, a nice size and all that kind of thing. You can see little individuals. And you can have a big forest of mitochondria that are sitting there minding their own business. They're moving up and down on microtubules, and they're making their ATP. And a listeria will come through, and it'll just plow right through. And it can actually even slice the mitochondria in half, and they lose their potential. So it's just, you know, it's a very slow but very, very powerful tank, and just nothing that it runs into affects its movement at all. So for the bacterium, that's a good thing because it helps it spread.
Isn't it a little bit of support for evolution that every time you do a mutation in the lab, it actually becomes less virulent?
Oh.
You couldn't make a more efficient pathogen in the lab somehow. That nature had already optimized.
Well,
the movement, the motion.
Oh, the motion.
Yeah.
Oh, we can make mutants that go faster.
Uh-huh.
We have mutants that go faster. They're not more virulent.
Uh-huh. Why is that?
I don't know.
Other questions?
Could you make a bead that would have a little,
Yeah. So something I didn't go into, but part of my lab works on some of these other pathogens that do it. In particular, a gram-negative pathogen, Shigella, that causes epidemic dysentery. So you try not to. Well, anyway, it does the same thing, but it's a gram-negative. Okay. So gram-positive bacterium has a thick, rigid cell wall on the outside that's, you know, absolutely dead, rock hard. A gram-negative bacterium has a thinner cell wall, and it's also got a membrane on the outside of that. And so one of the important differences is that everything that happens on the listeria cell surface is locked down and rigid. Things that happen on the Shigella cell surface, actually, there's a possibility for fluid motion. When we do that rifling experiment on Shigella, they don't rifle. But we don't yet know whether the lack of rifling for Shigella is because the biochemistry is different. The details of the biochemistry are very different. But they move. Or is it because the surface is fluid? And so we're trying to do a couple of different physical tricks and genetic tricks to see if we can get, you know, one to go into the other so we can really test what the difference is. My suspicion on very little data is that there's something about the growth of this helical polymer, and of course all actin helices have the same pitch. The growth of the helical polymer when it's partially attached to the surface somehow gives you a little bit of torque. But if you're on a fluid surface, then that torque is just relaxed in movement of the protein, and so you won't see it at large scale.
Okay, any more questions? If not, let's thank Judy again.